On the fourth anniversary of the Palestinian Intifada, Israeli military forces have invaded Jabalia, Gaza's largest refugee camp, leaving a trail of destruction, death, and carnage. More than 80 Palestinians have been killed, including at least 20 children, and some 300 injured in the ongoing rampage in Gaza. The Israeli military operation marks the deepest incursion into the Gaza Strip during the past 4 years, illustrating the devastating reality of the ongoing illegal Israeli occupation. Throughout the world, cries of condemnation for the current Israeli incursion have been sounded, from the halls of the United Nations to the chants of pro-Palestinian demonstrations in cities throughout the world. I had the opportunity to speak with Al Jazeera's English correspondent in the Gaza Strip, Leila Al-Haddad, who has been reporting from Jabalia refugee camp throughout the recent Israeli incursion. The interview provides a first-hand account of the current crisis in Jabalia, while also focusing on the growing call throughout the world to introduce an economic boycott of Israel in regard to its consistent disregard for basic human rights and international law.
The reality of the incursions right now is a battle that's seen the Middle East's most powerful army, and by some estimates, the world's third or fourth most powerful army, pitted against the most densely populated camp in the Gaza Strip and the world, and resistance fighters armed with rustic homemade weapons. So it's a very lopsided battle that, by Beit Sail and the Israeli Human Rights Group's estimates, seen over 40% of the fatalities be civilians. And it has many people questioning why this excessive use of force, why this disproportionate use of force against a civilian population, excessively populated population.
You use the term resistance fighters. In the perceptions or the mainstream media presentation of the events of Jabalia refugee camp and the incursions, the way that the death toll is presented is that some civilians, quote unquote, have died or caught in the crossfire, as they say. Maybe could you offer your perspectives as to the reality on the ground, in that the majority of the Palestinian population is involved in some way or another in supporting some type of resistance to the Israeli occupation?
That's true. I mean, I was in the Jabalia camp yesterday, and you had camp residents, standing side by side with these fighters who a lot of times are from the camp themselves. I mean, what makes them a fighter? They just put a face mask on and, you know, have either a Kalashnikov in their hand or some other homemade weapon, and, you know, boom, they're a branded resistance fighter. And together they are burning tires and trying to cover the camp's narrow alleys with plastic sheets to shield them from the view of the unmanned drones that monitor them from above. So again, I mean, according to Israeli Army spokesman I spoke with, anybody, almost any young man between the age of 16 and 35 is considered fair game and is considered automatically a fighter and a target, and in their view, a terrorist, armed or not armed. So, you know, there is a gray area, that's a very disturbing gray area there. And also these people, you know, I'm speaking to them. Jabalia is the first refugee camp in Palestine. It is where the first Palestinians in 1948 forced out of their homes in historic Palestine, fled to and sought refuge in. Until this day, you know, you find people, third and fourth generation refugees, and some of the original refugees that say, you know, we didn't do anything. We were kicked out of our homes, and they're chasing us even here where we sought refuge to. To them, in their perspective, they're defending their land. That's what they see this as, a defensive war, and, you know, Israel is encroaching on their territory. Even if you were going to say, okay, they're targeting, you know, fighters, and you still have this high civilian death toll, you know, and when asked why can't you distinguish between fighters and quote-unquote civilians, the Israeli army's response is they use the civilians as human shields. But, you know, to quote the deputy mayor of Jabalia, you know, an army that can strike and assassinate a person driving in a small car through a crowded street can easily distinguish between children, women, and resistance fighters. So there should be no reason why there's such a high civilian toll on the Palestinian side.
Mm-hmm. Now, Leila, you have recently spent time in the Jabalia camp. You said you were there yesterday. Can you maybe just offer people some reflections on what's going on? Can you describe what you saw?
Sure. My first impression was that on almost every block, the way the camp is divided is into blocks. So you might hear on the news block 1, 2, 3, or 4. That's the way that's divided. Basically, the blocks are small, one-story cement structures that were shelters that were set up for the refugees in 1948. Now they've sort of expanded. On almost every block of the camp, which again is the most densely populated place on earth, there's either a funeral going on, there's either demolished homes, the streets are completely upturned with sewage having mixed in with the drinking water, causing potential for hundreds of waterborne diseases. In the distance, you could hear ambulance sirens signaling, you know, yet another fallen Palestinian. And what also caught my attention was, again, residents and fighters hand in hand burning bushweeds and tires, trying to, in their own way, kind of protect their turf, putting up plastic and nylon sheets. Dozens of Israeli drones were whirring overhead, which give a live streaming view to the Israeli army of what's going on. What also struck me was that the Palestinians were fighting a formidable but almost invisible opponent, because the Israeli soldiers are seldom, if ever, seen. They're cocooned in the tanks and in state-of-the-art Apaches and now even unmanned drones that can fire missiles. So, again, it's a very lopsided battle. The streets were almost empty. Palestinians are staying indoors, scared for what could happen. You know, as one man said, it changes like the weather. It might be quiet one minute, and then an all-out battle. You know, it was quiet when I was there, and then all of a sudden I was on a man's rooftop, and out of nowhere an Apache appeared and began shooting at the house next to us. And at that same moment, a 20-year-old man died. So it is an all-out asymmetric war. I don't want to say war because that implies it's a symmetric war. And everything has been targeted. Schools have been canceled, because even the UN schools have been targeted. They're completely riddled with bullets. The windows are shattered. Chicken farms, citrus groves, refugee shelters, hospitals, charities, and even mosques have all been targeted and are partially demolished.
Ariel Sharon has made it very public throughout the world that he's currently pushing towards the so-called disengagement plan with the Gaza Strip, pullout of the Israeli settlements and the military occupation of the Gaza Strip. The recent activities obviously seem to be in complete contradiction with this rhetoric. So maybe can you offer your perspectives on this?
Many people see the Israeli withdrawal as a tactical move. They say Israel Sharon is a military man. He's only interested in escalation, you know, and anything he does is going to be militarily oriented, that he wants to leave, having given the Israeli population the impression that this was a victory, not a defeat. And of course, there is this constant incongruity of him escalating and then saying, or being portrayed as a man of peace, as the only man that's pushed so hard to withdraw from settlements in the Gaza Strip, you know, in the United States and in Europe. Of course, what we need to keep in mind is even his so-called disengagement plan only intends to disengage or withdraw from Gaza settlements, which, you know, is an obligation, first of all, because the settlements are illegal by international law. But even when he withdraws, Israel will maintain control over Gaza's borders, sea, and airspace, and will maintain the right to re-enter the Strip at any time it deems necessary. So it's not really a withdrawal in the sense of the term.
Now, you described, obviously, what is not a withdrawal, which are the current actions in Jabalia refugee camp. Maybe can you go back to your visit there yesterday, mm-hmm. and if you could describe some incidents which you saw. I mean, you described the general kind of atmosphere, but is there any interactions that you had that really stood out? And the reason I ask this question is because there's very little humanization of Palestinians in the camps. So maybe can you speak about certain memories or human instances you remember from your visit?
When I was in the eastern part of the camp in what's called the Tel Zatar area, I was in one household with about 40 people, and the children were all inside. The oldest was about 10, and she was teaching all her younger siblings their lessons, because they haven't been able to go to school for, you know, over a week now. You know, and that really struck me. And, you know, I asked her how it was like for her, and coming from a 10-year-old, describing to me what's going on. And She was saying how the children were scared and they all, you know, came to her. They were crying when the Apaches came overhead when they were shooting. And other instances, a woman was telling me how, you know, her house was demolished, you know, while she was still inside without warning. Other people were outside, were maybe in their jobs teaching in the school when the houses were demolished and were scared to go back. You know, with our assistance yesterday, we had a flak jacket. We were able to retrieve some of their belongings for them. So there's just this complete sense of hysteria and chaos in the camp. People are really scared for their lives. Like I said, they're fighting this invisible, formidable enemy in which they feel completely powerless. So this is the situation, and about 50,000 of the people there now are living without electricity, without water. And every day on the radio, on the local radio stations, they'll call in and, you know, plea for help from the Red Cross and give their exact location. For 4 days, the Red Cross wasn't allowed in. I think for the first time yesterday, they were allowed to give some water and supplies to the people there.
Now, looking at a little bit of a broader issue, you've recently wrote an article for Al Jazeera where you expand on this idea of a boycott of Israel. You mentioned specifically the ruling of the International Court of Justice, which declared the West Bank's so-called separation barrier illegal and urged Israel to demolish the structure. Now, given the reality in the West Bank with the separation barrier, what is commonly referred to as the apartheid wall, and the current incursions into Jabalia camp and what we saw in May and June in Rafah refugee camp, can you explain for us why you focused on this call for a boycott and why you think perhaps this is an important thing for people in the West to consider?
A boycott is one of the tools in international law, or sanctions or boycott, that are used to force countries that haven't been abiding by international law to do so. So it's to implement the, you know, the rulings of international law. In this case, the International Court of Justice ruled the barrier illegal. And in the past, when it's ruled, I drew the analogy to South Africa's occupation, a boycott resulted that eventually saw the downfall of the apartheid regime. And for a long time, people have been making this in comparison, and only after the ICJ ruling has it really begun to gain momentum. And so I was just sort of drawing on these parallels and this what I saw as this trend, and what many analysts see as this trend that's developing, it being one of the only ways that can really force Israel to abide by international law, putting pressure on it, maybe making it, as was South Africa, an international pariah to relieve the occupation on the Palestinian people. Of course, I mentioned there's several local boycott attempts have been attempted in the past, but they've been unsuccessful, and mainly because they can't really take off unless there's an international lead, unless there's a lead, an American or a European or a Western lead to such an international boycott effort. And, you know, the comparisons to apartheid are very real here. They're not just rhetoric or propaganda, as many people like to portray them. I mean, recently, Beit Salem came out with a report that showed about 42 different roads that are completely off-limits for Palestinians. Everything here is categorized by permits, and even the permits are issued under an ambiguous security scheme, which isn't explained, which isn't written down. So it is very much really separation and just a matrix of administrative procedures to allow Palestinians to travel, even within their own towns and cities.
Now, just one final question for you. Maybe can you explain to us why you feel that it's important for people in the West, people in Canada, to be focusing on the situation in the territories and specifically in the coming days on Jabalia refugee camp?
I think it's important because without international attention and pressure to the issue, the offensive could escalate. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon basically gave his army the green light to do whatever was necessary, in his view, to stop the rocket fire, which, of course, being loose, attacking the civilian population. And without international pressure and scrutiny, this could go continued unstopped. In the past, when there has been a little bit of international pressure, they've withdrawn suddenly, or at least, you know, the offensive hasn't continued.
You have been listening to an interview with Leila El Haddad, Al Jazeera's English correspondent in the Gaza Strip. On the fourth anniversary of the Palestinian Intifada, Israeli military forces have invaded Jabalia, Gaza's largest refugee camp, leaving a trail of destruction, death, and carnage. It was in Jabalia refugee camps, crowded alleyways, that the first Palestinian Intifada began. In the current incursion, more than 80 Palestinians have been killed, including at least 20 children, and some 300 seriously injured in the ongoing rampage in Gaza. The Israeli military operation marks the deepest incursion into the Gaza Strip in the past 4 years, illustrating the devastating reality of the ongoing illegal Israeli military occupation. Throughout the world, cries of condemnation for the current Israeli incursion have been sounded, from the halls of the United Nations to the chants of pro-Palestinian demonstrations in cities throughout the world. To read current up-to-date reports from the Gaza Strip, visit Al Jazeera's English news service at english.aljazeera.net. That's english.aljazeera.net. For more detailed information and analysis concerning the ongoing Israeli military occupation and the Palestinian Intifada, visit www.electronicintifada.net. That's www.electronicintifada.net. This interview has been recorded and produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christophe.